So I'm going to call the House Committee on Education to order for Thursday, February 2nd, 2012. Welcome, everyone. We always like to remind people to turn off their cell phones while you're in the committee room. It tends to play havoc with the audio system and makes it very difficult for people in Jamaica to listen clearly to the activities here this morning. So we're going to take, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4016. Representative Gelser would like to testify first.
Would you like me to run through the bill prepared?
Erin, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4016 adds employee or volunteer for organization providing child-related services or activities, employee of higher education institution, coach, assistant coach, or trainer of child, athlete, and individual who provides guidance, instruction, or training in youth development activity to list of public and private officials required to report child abuse, requires school boards to adopt rules and take certain actions related to abuse of students by students, declares emergency effective upon passage. We do have a -3 amendment, specifies inclusion of just employee of higher education institution, excludes community-based nonprofit organizations whose primary purpose is to provide confidential direct services to victims of domestic violence. It removes the requirement to notify parents or guardian of the initiation of an investigation involving sexual abuse or sexual conduct if the child is 11 or under, and the ability of education provider to determine whether to provide notification of parents to guardian if the child is 12 or older. And Representative Gelser.
Representative Gelser.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, and Oregon's only land, sea, sun, and space grant institution, making it a very special institution in the state. Oregon State University, if you're wondering. Thank you for hearing House Bill 4016. I wanted to briefly explain what this bill does and what the amendment does. The bill, as we propose to amend it, would simply expand the list of individuals that are required to be mandatory reporters of child abuse to include employees and staff of higher education institutions who, as it turns out, are not currently covered, and to also include staff and volunteers of youth-serving organizations, whether those be public or private organizations. The -3 amendment removes some language that you've received some emails about that related to a different issue, and that had to do with how parents are notified when incidents take place at school between two students, particularly incidents of a sexual abuse nature. That issue became complicated. The language did not accomplish what we had hoped to accomplish, and so we have removed all of that language, with the exception of clarifying that when school districts identify a person in a school building that is designated to receive a report of child abuse, there would be an alternate person in the event that that designated person was the person that the student felt unsafe with, and that school boards clearly have a policy of how teachers are to handle student-to-student abuse on campus in terms of reporting. They are already required under law to report that abuse. This just cleans up that section of the statute. So all we have left is expanding this list of individuals for mandatory reporters. I know that we've all received a number of emails that have been generated by the Oregon Christian Homeschool Network that have raised some questions. One of the concerns was that this would really have a chilling effect on volunteers because they would not know how to recognize the subtle signs of child abuse. How would I know how to talk to a child, or how would I know how to elicit this information? And that's why it's so important to understand what mandatory reporting is. It does not require anyone to interview a child to be proactively looking for abuse. It is simply this: a person having reasonable cause to believe that any child with whom the official comes in contact has suffered abuse, or that any person with whom the official comes in contact has abused a child, shall immediately report or cause a report to be made. In other words, if just in the normal course of your life you become aware or concerned that a child has been abused or an adult that you know is abusing a child, you need to make a call and ask for help. Hopefully, anyone would do this anyway, just as a matter of human obligation. Unfortunately, these calls are very difficult to make. Nobody likes to make them. And when you're a mandatory reporter, it takes it out of that area of gray. It really takes away any concern of guilt. You know that you have to do it, so you don't have to describe to someone why you made the protocol. The law told you that you had to do it. Even with our mandatory law, child abuse is grossly underreported in the state of Oregon, and that's why we need to expand it. There were also questions about the training requirements. We are not putting any mandate on organizations, school districts, or anyone else to train people to be mandatory reporters. That is, training is not required in the statute. However, a couple of sessions ago, we did pass legislation requiring school districts to make available annually training to parents and school staff about how to recognize and report child abuse. Ironically, I received the notification for the Corvallis School District's annual training last night on my Parent Teacher Association list. In order to be good partners, the Department of Human Services at that time put up a web page where anyone can go and watch the video that we all watch once every 2 years. You can just click that link and you can go and watch it. But again, there is no training requirement because we are not asking people to diagnose. We are just asking people when they see a kid that they reasonably believe is in trouble, they're concerned about it, they go away, they're thinking about this child, that they call and let someone know who does have that training so they can figure out what is going on. There was a question about whether the liability or responsibility for reporting would rest with the individual or with the organization, whether that was the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts or the school district or the community college. This is a requirement on the individual. And if you read through the statute, the way that the statute is worded, and Melissa Sidlak is here who drafted the bill to talk about that, it is wholly on that individual, not on the organization. There was a question from one of you the other day about whether there is a statute of limitations. Could someone at the age of 40 come back and say, you know, when I was 7, I told this person that I was being abused and they did not do anything to help me? There is a statute of limitations in the statute, which is 419B.0103. There is an 18-month statute of limitations. It's also important to note that it is very, very rare that anyone is ever prosecuted for failure to report child abuse. This is partly due to how difficult it would be to do so. You have to be able to prove that that person had knowledge and then made a decision to not report that abuse. I did some research to try to find out how often this happens and found a case in Florida where a case was brought for failure to report and the person was acquitted. And in this case, it says in 2008, a student told North Fort Myers High School science teacher Eric Zispin that her stepfather had beaten her and been sexually abusing her since she was a child. She asked him not to tell anyone so that she could tell her mother first. But a few days later, the girl's stepfather shot and killed her mother, then beat his stepdaughter, fracturing her skull and breaking one of her fingers. Mr. Zispin was charged but later acquitted of a first-degree misdemeanor for failing to report the alleged abuse. And instead, he was fined by the Department of Education. Had the teacher come forward sooner, the outcome might have been different. You never know. And that is why reporting of child abuse is so important. It is uncomfortable. Our own discomfort about doing difficult things, I believe, is overshadowed by the discomfort of a child whose life may be in danger or who is suffering in silence from sexual or physical abuse. And I think we can see the chilling effect that lack of reporting has on the health of children and the long-term outcomes of children if you look at what's recently happened with Penn State. In this case, for years, adults knew that children were likely being harmed, and nobody reported this to the authorities that could have stepped in and helped those children. People believed that the internal policies of the university would be able to wrap around and step in and protect these children, but because there was not a clear mandatory reporting requirement, nobody reported directly to the police. I believe they should have as a basic moral obligation, but the law would make it clear in our state that none of our universities, none of our community colleges, none of our nonprofit organizations wind up in that same place where children are harmed because nobody made the appropriate report. And unfortunately, we have had that in Oregon as well. In the situation of the Oregon Boy Scouts, there was an internal policy within the Boy Scouts to deal with that internally and not make a report, proactively not to make a report to law enforcement or the Department of Human Services. This law would make that type of internal policy illegal by ensuring that these reports go directly to those that can actually help our kids. Ultimately, the law motivates reporting among uneasy people because it removes any ambiguity that they may have, and it will make Oregon kids safer. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. I have the first one that I'm trying to figure out how the law works with a volunteer versus somebody that's got paid employment. So you and I are state representatives. We're always state representatives 24 hours a day. So I get how the mandatory reporter law works for us. But if somebody volunteers at an organization, they only do that sometimes, and they may not always be a volunteer. How exactly does the law apply to somebody's, I mean, when is that mandatory reporter law in effect for them, and when is it not? And
thank you, Mr. Chair, for asking that question and reminding me of a point that I meant to make. This bill does not apply to all volunteers of organizations, only those that have care and control of children. So it's not, if you're thinking about a soccer field, for instance, the mandatory reporting requirement in this bill would apply to the soccer coach, but not to the volunteers that are sitting in the snack shed selling the donuts. We're really looking at those individuals that have direct care of children. It would apply 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just as it does to our legislative staff, just as it does to all of the people that are hired to work in this building, just as it does to teachers, just as it does to custodial staff in school buildings, to maintenance workers in school districts who never have contact with children. All of these individuals would become mandatory reporters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And again, I would suggest all of us should, at the very least, be voluntary reporters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think there is no reason to not report suspected abuse, regardless of whether you're a mandatory reporter. Unfortunately, not everybody shares that perspective.
Questions? Representative Kamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, what is the current age boundaries? If somebody's 21, should I be reporting if I think there's possible abuse, that they're still living in a parent's home or something?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kamm, this bill applies to abuse of children, which are individuals under the age of 18. So to be triggered, you would have to first believe that the person is a child. This might be a case in a community college or a university class where the professor or the teacher is unclear of the age of the students in the class. They would need to understand that the student was a child. They would both need to suspect abuse and believe the person was under the age of 18 for the requirement to be triggered.
Thank you. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the definition clarification, because as we move to the 40-40-20 plan, we will definitely be having children younger than 18 on our college campuses, possibly in our community colleges. So it makes a difference.
Representative Conger.
So first question is, are we going to hear from legislative council on this? Are we going to have an opportunity to ask?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Conger. Belissa is here from Legislative Council, who can talk about the language in the bill. Also, DHS is in the room should people have questions about how the mandatory reporter statute works, training, any of those types of things as well.
Okay. Some of my questions may be
follow-up.
Yeah, better answered by them, but one follow-up that I think you can answer. So that there's a notification requirement. Can you talk about that for a child who's 11 years and younger?
Thank you for that question, Representative Conger, Chair Wingard. That is all removed in the Dash 3 amendment.
Okay. I have a question about the statute of limitations, which you touched on, but if you don't know the answer to this, it's okay. How does the statute get told?
How does the statute get told? I have it. What do you mean by get told? What does it say?
No, told, T-O-L-L-E-D. When does it start to run? When does the 18 months start to run?
At the commission of the offense.
Okay, so it's not the recollection of the victim or something.
Correct.
There's been a lot of unclarity about that.
Correct. And that's the language. It's 18 months after the commission of the offense.
May I have one more?
Further?
On the liability side, you and I have talked about this. And again, if the answer is not crystal clear, I'm happy to talk it over with Ledge Council. But the you touched on liability attaching to the individual, and so there, to be clear, there's no joint and several liability for the organization. And let's use a volunteer as an example. So the volunteer is a mandatory reporter, fails to report child abuse, liability flowing up to the organization. Is there ever a case where there could be? For example, if the organization didn't provide training for the volunteer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, I have asked that question, and I think there are people here that can explain it, but the way that I understood the answer was no, unless that organization itself has developed a policy that requires that volunteer, in addition to complying with the law, to report to law enforcement, and DHS has a requirement for the volunteer to report to them, and then they have the knowledge and they don't report, but that if the organization does not have a policy about it, this becomes a matter between the individual and the state. I would also point out on the issue of liability, because someone had asked a question about liability coverage. Organizations that have that are taking volunteers and putting them in direct contact, care, and control of children, their greater liability is going to come from that individual actually harming the child rather than that individual somehow becoming aware of something that happens outside of their responsibility and failing to report it. So this would be covered under any liability issues that that organization already has. I would argue this would be very diminutive compared to the risk of having a coach with eight little girls on a Saturday morning at the park.
Right. No, I understand. There are different issues, different sources of liability, and both potentially ones where the organization should be concerned about addressing them. I want to talk more about liability, but I think I'll hold that for the attorneys and let them respond. That's it for me.
Thank you. Representative Dembrough.
Mr. Chair, who do we have testifying? Because my question might be better posed to somebody from DHS or whatever.
So we do have someone from DHS. We have two attorneys that are going to be on the phone. So all those types of questions.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I believe DHS is not signed up but is available should people have questions for them.
And including the RLC attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I received a number of emails, and none of them said what organization they were with, so I don't know if they were independent or whatever. Their concerns regarding Section 3 and any other concerns, because I imagine you received the same emails, where you dropped out certain language that you mentioned a bit ago. Do you feel that you had met the concerns of that the folks had conveyed in their emails, or do you think there are still some lingering issues out there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, as it relates to the parental notification and that differentiation between children 11 and younger and those 12 and older, that issue is removed from the bill altogether. I think that otherwise there's a policy disagreement about whether or not volunteers and private and religious organizations should be subject to mandatory reporting, because that is a difference of opinion. I don't believe that's been resolved. Our office did receive those. We did begin asking what was generating them, because we noticed many of the talking points and, frankly, many of the words in the emails were precisely the same, and we were sent a copy of the alert that came from the Oregon Christian Homeschooling Network. So I believe that's where they came from.
Okay. Quick follow-up. Can you tell me, I see the alphabet in the room here. Do we have, various organizations?
That was meant in a loving way.
It was, absolutely. Yeah. Group hug. Have school organizations that are representing school boards and others, have they come in support of this? Have they weighed in? Are they aware of the bill? Can you just give me an idea of where we are with our school partners?
Sure. Thank you for that question, Co-Chair Wingard and Representative Huffman. I would never speak for another organization. However, I can convey my conversations with them to you, and that is that with the amendments that we have made to the bill, we have satisfied the biggest concerns of these organizations, and none of them are opposed to the bill. We'll be speaking against the bill, and is that consistent? People in the back, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish?
So I was looking at, looking at the coaching piece and the volunteer aspect, mm-hmm. and you said something that caught my ear, which was, that these volunteers would not just be mandatory reporters while they're coaching the sport. They'd be 24/7, 7 days a week. This doesn't describe, though, or define, and my husband coaches, so I would hope to shout, ethically, we're going to do this all the time, but you know, when you've got parents, for example, who coach, they're coaching their neighbors, they're coaching their kid, you know, neighbor's kids, and we coach soccer in the fall, and we coach basketball in the winter, and we don't coach anything in the spring, and then there's a little bit of stuff in the summer. What about that gap window that we're not a coach or we're not belonging to an organization, yet there's someone who's been through the training? Somebody going to come back and say, well, you know, I'm not a mandatory reporter in this period because I'm off season for one season. Where is that kind of safety net for a person? I mean, obviously we want people to report all the time, but, you know, you got this window of time where someone who coaches in the community, a bunch of different sports, but they might have a three-month window that they're not coaching. How does this apply to that person in that window? Because I don't see anything that either covers them or doesn't cover them, or, you know, well, you're a coach two seasons of the year, you should know better, therefore we're going to zap you with this.
Thank you, Chair Winger, Representative Parrish. My understanding is that as long as you are engaged in a way that this definition would apply to you, that mandatory reporting would apply to you. I remain a mandatory reporter even when we're out of session. I guess I'm still a state representative, and so are you when we are not in session. But teachers, for instance, are still mandatory reporters in the summer. Doctors are still mandatory reporters when they are on vacation. Hopefully what this does is raises the awareness and kind of makes that internal click for people that it's okay to make these reports, that it's important to make these reports, and the issue of being mandatory becomes somewhat secondary, and people just recognize the obligation they have as community members to make these reports when they are concerned.
Philip? I guess I have some concern in that window because a teacher is paid 12 months of the year. We are paid when we walk out of this building, you know, 12 months of the year. That coach is a volunteer to start with, and then they're not in the middle of coaching. And I'd hate to, you know, see somebody come back around and say, well, you missed the boat on this. And because my kids walk into the grocery store, and dad, my husband's still a coach, even though it's not season. They identify him as a coach and being a coach. And I'd hate to see, you know, somebody in that position. And like I said, I'm hoping to shout where I'll do in the reporting piece. But I'd hate to see somebody in the position who is not currently attached to something, still has that designation in their community of being a coach, and then suddenly, you know, in the middle of a summer or off season or something happens, and somebody decides to, you know, peg that coach for not doing something. That bothers me that this is not a little bit more clear in that.
Okay. Thank you for that question, Co-Chair Winger, Representative Parrish. I think the issue here is that we don't have a history in our state or any other of people coming after people when something happens. The standard for reporting isn't that you, because you're a mandatory reporter, you have the requirement to have kind of supernatural powers to be aware of what's happening in other people's homes. The requirement is simply you see a child in danger, you make that report. And I think that it matters not whether a person is being paid or not paid for that child. When an adult is aware that that child is being harmed, the report should be made. So no one is asking this coach to go interview parents or do something else. It's, I see this kid come in with a black eye, or this child tells me that his father did something to him in the bedroom last night. That's what triggers the report, regardless of what time of year it is.
Thank you, Representative Comp, and we'd like to get a couple attorneys in.
Yes, it'll be brief. I just have a question of, well, Aaron's leaving, but committee staff. Is there a subsequent referral on this bill?
No. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Comp, there is not currently.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I asked a question because when I was a school principal, administrator at a high school, I did have occasion where I had a 17-year-old, almost 18, and when I would call DHS, they would ask me, well, how old is this student? And I would say, 17. They go, well, we have a lot more severe situations with children at the ages of 8, 10, and 12, so we don't know that we'll ever get to this case. So my question about subsequent referral is, likely this is going to increase the workload for several agencies, DHS, TSPC, and I don't know what's the fiscal impact. That's my question.
And Representative Comp, Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. I have been in discussion with DHS. Nobody has indicated that there would be an increased fiscal as a result of this. I think you raise an important point. One of the other concerns that was raised in the emails was, if I call, then someone's going to lose their children, and all of these things that are very expensive and very painful for families will happen. There is a process that DHS goes through when they receive these calls, and I think generally you will find that there is a desire to make sure that everything gets reported. Oftentimes you might have multiple reports on the same child, which is what helps to elevate that case up for an intervention. But I am not aware that there is an increased fiscal or request for additional general fund allocation as a result of this legislation.
Mr. Chair, comment? I know.
Representative Cohn?
Thank you. I too am passionate about this subject because as an assistant principal that dealt with disciplinary issues, the person that I'm talking about was being strangled by their father that morning on a Friday morning, and he came to me for assistance, and there was no place that I could have for him to go over the weekend away from that environment because of the processing time it takes. We ended up putting him, he did have a PO officer at that time, and thankfully he had a PO officer. We ended up putting him in juvenile corrections over the weekend in order to keep him safe. This is a very, very serious subject.
And Representative Comp, I would agree. And Tanya Hunt is here from the Clackamas Children's Center, and I think she may be able to touch on some of the decisions that we have to make here in the legislature about the resources that we allocate to this. If you know the Philip Morris money that's come forward, it's my understanding that the Attorney General has not allocated a dime of that money towards our children's network and the centers that diagnosed this abuse. And that is something that we can work on together to ensure that we are meeting our obligation to have resources available to respond to children in danger.
Okay, thank you. For the sake of time, we need to push on. And we have Joan Demarest on the phone. Joan, are you with us?
Just 1 second. We're transferred until 10 o'clock that night to get him in the safe place. And that happened at 7 a.m. in the morning. My entire day.
Joan? Joan? Joan, are you with us?
Yep, let's call the other one.
We'll come back. Yep.
And I don't think that situation is more than the people. There's problems attracting all that criminal stuff.
Yeah, we've always had some.
Christian.
Speaking.
Christian, it's Matt Wingard, currently the co-chair of the House Education Committee. How are you doing?
Hi, Representative Wingard. How are you doing?
I'm good. You are on speakerphone and in the committee room right now. We appreciate your willingness to testify. First of all, we just need you to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Christian Rogendorf. I'm a lawyer practicing in Portland, Oregon.
And can you give us a little background at all about yourself or the firm and the kind of cases you do related to child abuse?
Sure. We've been, for the last decade that I've been at O'Donnell Clark and Crew, we've handled hundreds of sex abuse cases on behalf of victims, both adults and children, of childhood sexual abuse.
Okay. Did you have any kind of an opening statement you wanted to make, or do you just want to make yourself available for questions?
No, I'm just happy to take questions.
Okay. Do you have questions?
I would listen to your question.
Okay, so Christian, I wanted to ask you what the current standard liability that volunteer organizations face is.
Well, they've currently, since 1999, and the Fearing and Lorem cases, both of which were handled by Kelly Clark, they've been liable not only for negligence on behalf of their employees, which has always been the case, but also they've also been liable for intentional torts, such as sexual abuse or anything else like in that respect.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and the liability they face under the vicarious liability from those cases is called respondeat superior or strict liability. It means that they can be liable without any fault, individual fault on their own. In other words, if you have a Boy Scout leader or a priest and their job involves interacting with children, and that interaction itself leads to the abuse, then the organization is liable whether they did anything wrong or not. That's current law.
And how does the bill change the liability standard, if at all?
Well, you know, there's two answers to that. Number one, it doesn't really change it at all. That's because already if an organization was informed or knew that a child was being abused and its agent didn't report it, that would be negligence right now. And organizations have always been liable for the negligence of their agents. If the bill passes, what this would do is the liability part of the equation would be made more clear. It would result in the ability to bring a suit based on the theory of negligence per se. That's not a different claim. What it says is that the statute, or Oregon statute, establishes the proper duty of care of an organization, and that duty of care is to report suspected child abuse.
Is that an easier standard to prove?
Well, yes, it is. In the cases that we deal with, it's not going to become law. If it does become law, it's not going to become law until this year, or I suppose January of next year. But it won't apply to cases that have occurred prior to that.
Do you have any questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you so much for being on the phone today. How frequently have you ever seen a tort brought against an individual for failure to report abuse? How frequently does that happen?
That's a very good question. It's been referred to and talked about in child abuse reporting CLEs constantly in the decade that I've been practicing law. All the child abuse reporting CLEs that we have to take, the continuing legal education classes, they all mention that this could be a viable tort, but in all my years, I haven't brought one. And we've alleged that the reporting statute shows that there's a duty of care there, that you have to report these sorts of things, but I haven't brought any of them. And I did want to add one thing. The one true benefit I see from this, you might consider it window dressing in the tort realm, except for the fact that, as a practical matter, a lot of organizations, and specifically the Boy Scouts, key their reporting requirements to state law. In other words, right now, if a scout is abused and somebody either knows it or suspects it in the scouts, their internal protocol is not to call the police unless state law requires them to. And so that's a big step to go ahead and say that, well, state law does require you to now. So that would capture those instances where it's found out but not reported right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I were wanting to bring a tort against someone for failure to report, is your firm the likely candidate in the case that I would come to pursue that?
Well, I guess if it happened now, we do handle current child abuse cases. We've had probably a couple of dozen over the years involving still children. But for the most part, we deal with adult victims of child abuse. And so In theory, yes, but it's really almost no part of my practice that I can imagine right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Conger.
Thank you. Christian, I have several questions for you based on what you said. The first is, when you're talking about the vicarious liability for employers, that's one thing, but when you're talking about volunteers, that seems like it might be a little bit different. Can you explain the difference with respect to current law and what this bill would do for organizations that deploy potentially large numbers of volunteers on kind of a one-off basis? Think of a, you know, not of the coach situation, but of the vacation Bible school that goes on for a week or something.
It doesn't matter how long one is an agent for. If they're an agent, and an agent includes either an employee or a non-employee, a volunteer, then they're liable. The Searing case in 1999 was a priest. That's clearly an employee of the Archdiocese. The Loram case was a Boy Scout volunteer. In fact, I don't even know if he had a specific title in that case. I think he might have been the Scoutmaster. It was our case, but I'm too fogging on the details right now. But it doesn't matter. If the organization has control over the specific action that leads to the abuse, if they have the right to control, not even if they exercise it, if they have the right to control, then they're currently liable under law right now.
But Christian, that's not the context that we're talking about here. We're talking about reporting child abuse that takes place probably outside the organization in most cases.
Let me try and follow you. Is the question then, would it expose the organization to any liability for what everybody knows, whether or not they learned it in the course and scope of their agency?
So, let me try to put it in context for you. I think that if you look at the purpose of the bill, I think we can all get our arms around that it's to expand mandatory reporting to a broader population in order to try to catch more instances of abuse and get them stopped or prevent them. And so what I think that the concern might be from organizations and individuals is that if they are picked up by this new bill, if this bill were to pass and a volunteer, for example, at a, you know, who spends a week teaching kids how to make crafts at a vacation Bible school, they then become mandatory reporters. So from an individual volunteer's perspective, I think there would be concerns about what that means to be a mandatory reporter. The nature of my question relates to the organization's concern about their additional liability as a result of having their volunteers at this vacation Bible school all be classified as mandatory reporters. So under current law, what liability would the sponsor of the vacation Bible school potentially have for volunteers who failed to report instances of potential abuse that didn't occur at the vacation Bible school? We all understand that if they're occurring during the event, the agents of the organization are acting within the scope of their agency, or I think everyone understands that. Under the new law, if it were to pass, what would be the potential liability of the organization if a volunteer failed to report?
I got you. Thank you for clarifying, Representative. The current law is they certainly could potentially be liable for negligence right now. If an agent learns something in the course and scope of their agency right now, then the organization knows. If the organization has a particular special relationship with the child, which is usually established by taking custody or control, which would be sort of an in loco parentis type of, in substitute of the parent's role, if they actually take charge of the child, there's arguably right now liability already. So would the bill change that liability, make it more stringent? I don't think it would make it more stringent. I think it would make it easier to prove in a court of law. For cases going forward, I should say.
Oh. Okay. Can you help me understand then, or at least speculate, and I am asking you to speculate on this. I know you don't necessarily have knowledge of the scouts' internal policy, but you mentioned the internal policy of the scouts that they would not report unless state law requires it. Why would that be?
That's their own internal policy. I mean, we've been litigating against the scouts for, you know, a decade or so, and one of the things that they've always done is they've kept child abuse accusations, allegations, investigations very quiet and very secret. And the reason for that, of course, is reputation. You know, and in fact, it says in their internal documents a lot of times, you know, let's not get the press involved. We don't want to make the organization look bad. And so that's a significant concern for a lot of these organizations. And by requiring reporting, then they have no out to say, well, we didn't have to. That's far more of a common response than one would like to see.
Christian, could it be that they are concerned about liability for falsely reporting? And
well, there's immunity for that. There's a report of child abuse that's made that's unsubstantiated. I believe, if I remember right, there is a current law, there's an immunity for people who report in good faith. If it's malicious, of course, I think there's always an action on that. But for the scouts to go ahead and forward that on at a sort of corporate level, the risk of a defamation suit, I think, is pretty slim because they have a fair reporting privilege.
So, one more.
So, I'm a follow-up?
Christian, I appreciate your testimony, and I guess the part that we haven't touched on, so if I understand correctly, the negligence per se standard that you're talking about, if we put this in place, it just becomes easier to prove that an organization failed to comply with the law, and therefore that sets the negligence standard. You don't have to actually prove negligence. You just prove failure to comply with the reporting requirement.
Well, there's several elements to negligence. One is either a special relationship or what's called danger creation. In other words, if you dig a hole in the sidewalk, then you're liable for somebody falling into it unless you warn them about it because you've created that hole. Special relationship is you're holding the child's hand as you're walking down the street and they fall into the pit. Well, then you're liable to the child because you're taking care of the child. That's the one element. The other element is that your conduct was unreasonable in light of the situation. And the unreasonableness standard is what goes to the jury. You know, you have to prove all the facts. You know, you're walking down the street, you're holding the child's hand, the child fell in. You have to prove all those facts, but you also have to prove that you go ahead and did something unreasonable. In other words, you were walking down the street with your eyes closed as opposed to with your eyes open, even though you were holding this kid's hand. That's the unreasonableness. If you try to stop them from falling in the hole and grab them and they fall anyway, well, then you have an act of negligence. You've tried to stop it. So what the negligence per se standard does is say, as a matter of law, the state has said that it is illegal to walk down the street with your eyes closed. So if you do that, and we can prove that you were closing your eyes, and you've admitted to it in testimony or whatnot, then that element of unreasonable conduct is presumed in the law. So the negligence per se standard isn't a different theory of negligence. It isn't proving the case, because of course you not only need to prove liability, you need to prove damages too. It's simply saying that your conduct was unreasonable, and we're going to find it unreasonable as a matter of law.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you for indulging me.
Thank you. Representative Parrish?
Thank you. You know, as you've looked at this bill, one of the concerns I have is, you know, kind of that notion of what really is the definition of a volunteer when you're talking about these private organizations. So my kids are in Scouts, And two weekends ago, they asked some parents to go with. My husband's not a scout master, but they needed extra sets of hands on a trip. Does that constitute being a volunteer when you're doing something like that? He's not signed a statement that he's volunteering for the organization. They asked for extra folks. This could also be chaperones at school dances. And, you know, we're starting to kind of get into, you know, when a parent shows up for something and is volunteering, are they put under this classification? And then the other thing, and the question I asked Representative Gelser, and I'd like to ask you as well, is, you know, what happens when you're a volunteer for a defined set of time? Like, we have at least 200 parents that come out and coach soccer in my community in the fall. They're coaches for 10 weeks, you know, but they're still recognized as coach when they're at the grocery store or, you know, at the park in the summertime. This doesn't really define what volunteer is and when that time period of volunteer is. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, a volunteer can be either an agent or not an agent. If they're not an agent, then they don't subject the organization to liability. An agency is created when it's kind of an archaic term. It's called a master and a servant. Usually they use principal and agent now. An agency is formed when all parties agree to have the person represent the organization in a defined capacity or even just generally. So again, if the organization has the right to control how that person participates, like with the chaperone instance, those chaperones and scouts, I would argue that absolutely they're agents because the scouts have the right to control their behavior while they're there. There's all sorts of different rules that scouts have about camping. One of the main ones is like no drugs or alcohol. They have the right to control, you know, what you have in your tent, no open flames in tents, and they do that, and they enforce those rules. So if the organization has rules that it can apply to volunteers, then those volunteers right now already are agents. And as far as whether or not the definition of volunteers matters, I don't think it does in the statute, to the extent that the word volunteer isn't going to subject the organization to liability if a master-servant relationship is not there.
Can I follow up?
Follow-up, Representative
Parrish. So the school sends out an email, you know, kids in sixth grade, school sends out an email, we're looking for parents to come chaperone the dance. Parents show up to help support. And essentially, all those people now are in this class of because they're going to enforce those rules about we don't want kids bringing whatever to school, knives and guns and, you know, drugs and alcohol. This puts all of those parents into that capacity. That's what I just heard you say. Can you clarify that for me?
Well, as far as the effect of the bill, if an adult is taking custody or control or care of a child, then they're going to be a mandatory reporter. If they're not within that definition, of course, then they don't have that obligation. But I believe, and I haven't gotten a chance to really study the bill. I read it yesterday. But I believe it's keyed on having that sort of caretaker relationship with the child, which means that if that caretaker relationship with the child is already something that, one, the organization can control, and two, the organization brings into being, then they currently already have tort liability. As far as whether or not they have to report, that's the issue of what you're trying to capture. If you're trying to be able to have an enforceable standard where people have to report child abuse, you're going to have to cover people like that because they're agents. And the law doesn't make a distinction between being an agent for 5 minutes and being an agent for 5 years. So there's certainly some tension there, but there's, I don't think, a better way to resolve it than to go ahead and have mandatory reporters for those people who take charge of children.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Christian, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Representative Weird, and thank you, Representatives, for allowing you to speak to you.
Appreciate your testimony. So now we will try to put Joan on.
Joan DeBrest.
Hi, Joan. This is Erin Seiler from the House Committee on Education. You are with the committee right now, and I will turn it over to Co-Chair Wingard.
Good morning, Joan.
Good morning.
Does she have an
Should I just proceed?
Does she have a statement?
If you just want to identify yourself for the record, and then I believe there are some questions of some of the members.
Okay, thank you. My name is Joan Demarest. I'm an attorney and a parent in Corvallis, Oregon.
Joan, did you have a statement you wanted to make before I unleash the committee to ask questions on you?
Sure. I know that you've been going for a while this morning, so I'll try to keep it brief. I am a former prosecutor. I prosecuted child abuse cases for years in the Benton County District Attorney's Office. I know from my personal experience in that capacity that one phone call does not trigger removal of a child from a home or criminal charges. Rather, it gets attention focused on that child for a period of time. Sometimes it's a short period of time while the concern is put to rest. Sometimes it is more time, and people who are more closely involved in the child's life have been chomping at the bit to assist the child in getting help. So a report is not going to put somebody in jail. It's not going to take a child from a home. It's just going to get a little bit of attention focused, and the experts in that field will be able to focus more attention if it's necessary. I'm now an attorney in private practice. I left the district attorney's office about 5 years ago. I myself just made a mandatory report a few weeks ago in a situation I became aware of. I, as an attorney, as a mandatory reporter, I appreciate having the law because it answers that question. Even as a prosecutor, I would sometimes have gut-wrenching situations where I wasn't sure what I should do. And when I became a mandatory reporter, it was a relief to me to have that question answered. I know who to call, and I know that if I have a suspicion, I know who to tell, and that I'm supposed to tell, and then I'm done. I don't have to stay up at night worrying about whether I've done what I should do for this child. I also, as a parent, I'm encouraging you all to support this bill because as I reviewed the statute, I became aware that the camp counselors, where my kids go to camp in the summer, they're not mandatory reporters. I'm also in a baby class put on by Lynn Benton Community College with my 6-month-old baby, and I discovered that the teacher for that class is not a mandatory reporter. This law will make these people mandatory reporters. These people are in situations where they have the ability to recognize possible abuse situations before anybody else can. It's sort of an early intervention with the baby class opportunity. And these are people who will see things, and the legislature should give them the relief of allowing them to be mandatory reporters, to allow them to know what to do and not have to have that gut-wrenching experience of what should I do? Have I done enough? Should I do anything? Because that's, having been in that experience myself, it's unpleasant. And being able to know I'm a mandatory reporter, this is what I should do, really does ease up the stress in those situations. So I think I've mentioned my big areas of concern, and I understand if you have questions, I'd be glad to take my best at answering them.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Thank you, Joan. And I think you answered the primary question I had hoped that you would hit. I know that some people have raised concerns that a report would cause a child to be removed from the home. Do you have a sense of what that standard is before a child is removed? We addressed that. I don't know if you could hear that on the phone, but a committee member had raised a question about how high the bar is before there is an intervention.
It is pretty high. I mean, I've staffed dozens of child abuse cases with DHS caseworkers, and only very rarely did we get to a situation where the child was actually removed from the home. Usually there's intervention attempted, and if there's like one family member who's causing the problem, that family member is dealt with without having to remove the child from the home. But it's definitely a situation where they look at that, where removing the child is absolutely the last resort when it's absolutely necessary.
And then one other question, Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Thank you. Joan, in your time at the Benton County District Attorney's Office dealing with child abuse issues, did you ever prosecute anyone for failure to report abuse?
Oh, no, no, never.
Thank you.
Question?
We had one situation where somebody, it was when the mandatory law first, mandatory reporting law first came into place, I think, and somebody had was really willfully not reporting a situation, and we became aware of it, and all we did was, you know, politely remind them about the mandatory reporting obligation, and that's all that happened.
Representative Denbrough?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. In your time working with the Benton District Attorney, I assume you had jurisdiction over Oregon State University or Lynn Benton Community College?
And right, so incidents that happened on their campuses would have been in our jurisdiction, yes. The Corvallis branch of LBCC, yeah.
So, you know, both of those institutions would have students on campus under the age of 18. And I'm wondering, were there any examples of problems that you experienced where things happened that should have been reported, that could have been reported, that should have been reported, that weren't that either were or weren't reported? Just to help us think through the milieu of a college campus as far as this issue goes.
Well, I can't say that I can think of any occasion where this occurred. I think the problem is that there's so much that is not reported that we don't know. We don't know what there is out there that's not getting reported. In terms of reports that came in from the campus, I can't think of any that did. Nope, not thinking of any. So I'm afraid I'm not able to really answer your question.
Okay, just a follow-up.
I was missing the point of it.
No. Just as a follow-up. No, I'm just, kind of wrestling with the, potential subtleties of that situation, where you have students who are, they're below the age of 18, but they're in some ways, emancipated. I mean, they're independent on a college campus, interacting with older students. And does that create problems? In terms of a relationship between a student who might be 21 and a student who's 17, for example, or 19 and 17. I'm not totally clear on how the law would work on that.
So are you talking about like a 17-year-old college student involved in a romantic relationship with a 21-year-old?
Let's say.
And you're worried that somebody might be a mandatory reporter in that situation?
Yes.
Okay, so the only crime I can think of that might constitute is, it'd have to be a more than 3-year age difference. So,
17
and 21. And can I just look at the statute for a minute?
Thank you.
So, Joan, while you're looking for that answer, can I have Tanya Hunt and Walt Beglin come up and be ready to testify when we're finished with Joan?
And maybe Representative Gelser can help me find the part of the statute that talks about what constitutes abuse.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I was in the back of the room. I don't have that part of the statute in front of me right now. However, it is the... I have too many folders here. I just walked to the back of the room. We can get that information to you later, Representative Denver. I think the concern is there is that 3-year limit. So if you had a 14-year-old, for instance, having a relationship with a 17-year-old, that... is very different than having a 16-year-old having a relationship with a 25-year-old.
Or a 19-year-old. I mean,
yeah. Well, 16 to 19 is 3 years. So the sexual abuse is described, sexual delinquency. We can follow up with that at a later point.
Representative Denbrough, are you?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Yes.
Joan, I don't think we have any more questions on the panel. I appreciate your testimony today.
Okay, thank you. If I could just say one last thing.
Sure.
I think from some of the questions that were raised earlier, it made me think of a situation where somebody may be a mandatory reporter during some of the year, but not all of the year, and I was imagining a situation where somebody becomes aware of abuse, and they think, oh, I could report this, or I might be required to report this if I'm a mandatory reporter right now, but then I don't have to report it if I'm not. And I don't see anybody being in a situation where they see abuse and then they're relieved that they don't have to do anything about it. I think the intent of this bill is to give people who are in the position of seeing abuse the relief of knowing what to do and knowing who to report and not having to have personal stress about deciding what to do about it. So I think it will be a relief to people who are encompassed into the mandatory reporting laws, and I strongly encourage you to support it. Thank you very much.
Joan, thank you very much for your testimony today. So also, would Stacey Ayers from DHS come forward for the panel as well? And Tanya, please feel free to start. Everyone be sure to introduce yourselves, identify yourselves for the record.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Tanya Hunt, and I serve as executive director of the Children's Center in Clackamas County, Oregon. We are one of the child abuse assessment centers in the state of Oregon, funded through the state CAMI fund out of the Department of Justice, Crime Victims Services Division. I am here today to ask for your support of House Bill 4016 with the -3 amendments. The Children's Center each year sees hundreds of children who are suspected victims of abuse. We see truly the worst of the worst in Clackamas County, and centers across the state do the same. We see children primarily for suspected sexual assault, but also in cases of severe physical assault with injury and severe cases of neglect, often resulting actually medical neglect and severe developmental delay for kids. I want to assure you that these children are not coming to us because of over-reporting. I want to assure you that these children are desperate to be heard, and that it is critical for our community's safety, for public safety in the state of Oregon, that we all take responsibility for children's safety. The mandatory reporter laws are just one small step towards that. I think this expansion to these additional mandatory reporters is absolutely appropriate. We know that children disclose by telling someone they trust. That usually is not someone in their home. Unfortunately, abuse often starts at home. They tell someone they trust. That could be a coach. It could be a scout leader. It could be a teacher. It could be someone in a variety of settings. We want to arm those people who have the care and control of children with the best possible response to those disclosures of abuse. We want to make sure that they understand their obligation and their opportunity to help that child. One of our recent cases at the Children's Center was a child who disclosed to her dog. She had no one else to tell. She disclosed to her dog. Thank heavens her mother overheard. Children are terrified to make this disclosure. Studies show that children will disclose 7 to 9 times before they are actually heard and that disclosure is responded to. It is shameful that we have lost sight of the forest for the trees because we are talking about the adult's liability, the adult's discomfort of being mandatory reporters when these children suffer in silence. And in fact, you should know that more children each year die from abuse and neglect than all childhood cancers combined in the state of Oregon. They're not dying because we have done everything possible to save them. They are dying because nobody told. and we must do everything we can to ensure that people tell and respond appropriately when there are suspected cases of abuse. And we must make sure there are the resources in place for our systems at DHS, law enforcement, child abuse assessment centers, and other services across the state who serve these victims of crime to make sure that they can respond appropriately and serve those victims. Thank you.
Walt. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're here to support, through the Dash 3 amendments, House Bill 4016. We applaud the efforts to enhance this bill. Frankly, this has been an asset to Oregon's children for years, and other states are just now coming on board with that particularized effort, and it's really been the centerpiece of us reaching the community and citizens on how to make sure to identify and report and then have an objective, thorough investigation done to see if a child has been abused. It's been Oregon's centerpiece for that, so we support that. Now, these three specific additions to the list of professionals, private or public, as it is currently listed, are good additions. Coaches, folks in services related, people that come in contact with kids on a regular basis. And I'll highlight the volunteers because we've had a lot of discussion here. Oregon has, this is new territory for this statute and for Oregon. I think it's the right direction to go. And I'll give you an example. In the Marion County District Attorney's Office, we have a whole cadre of volunteers that work with victims of abuse. It is the centerpiece of our victim assistance program. And the statute has not been clear on whether it applies to them, but we have chosen to make them mandatory reporters like our co-employees in our office 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and it has had no chilling effect. It has enhanced it, and it has brought the organization to a place we want to be. So I really like the look about that. These are the folks that are going to be in touch with kids on a daily basis. And, you know, frankly, as a parent, I've been to many of the different areas for the school district around kids, and I expect that to shoulder that responsibility. And I think that kind of redefines it for Oregon, and it's the right direction there. So we support it. Training is central to this, and attorneys in our office do a lot of training. That's going to be the key here, is getting to these organizations. They need this training anyway if they're having contact. They have these programs in place, and so we're here to help with that as well. Department of Human Services, district attorneys, law enforcement, assessment centers, we're here to help out with the training piece. The only area we had concern with on this bill is gone, and that is the Section 5 on the amendments to ORS 339-372, the board policies, and notice they're gone, so we do not have concerns anymore. Thank you.
Stacy, you don't need to make a statement if you just want to introduce yourself so the committee knows you're here to answer questions.
Sure. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stacy Ayers. My last name is spelled A-Y-E-R-S, and I am the Child Protective Services Program Manager for Department of Human Services. And I don't have prepared testimony, as you're aware, but I'm available to answer questions.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Stacy, could you tell us a little bit about the website, please?
Chair and Representative Gelser. The website that we have available is a mandatory. There are a number of things on our website, Oregon, at the Oregon DHS website. One of the things in particular I think you're referring to is the mandatory reporting training video, essentially. That it's a 25-minute video, and it goes through all of kind of the requirements of mandatory reporting. That it's, you know, it kind of explains the process, things that might happen, things that a child might say to you, the expectation. It's not that you go ahead and conduct the investigation as a mandatory reporter or try to prove that it did or didn't happen, but it is that I had this information and now I need to report it. And so it kind of it goes through the kind of broad spectrum of things that might happen and how one might come about that information, all the way from, you know, doctors and nurses and firefighters and police and legislators even potentially, and information that they might have received during their job or at other times.
Thank you. And another question, please.
Thank you. One of the concerns that has been raised in the emails that we received was that people would be liable if they had failed to recognize subtle forms of abuse. Mm-hmm. I'm currently a mandatory reporter. If a child living in the house next door to me turned up at the ABC ABC Center in Albany, which is our Child Abuse Assessment Center, with injuries related to child abuse, and I had never reported that because I hadn't recognized that when she was riding the bike down my street or having a play date with my kids, would I have failed in my mandatory reporting requirement?
Chair and Representative Gelser, I guess the way I would answer that is the statute does talk about having some reasonable suspicion, some reasonable grounds that it's not that you should be able to know what's happening in somebody else's house or even with your neighbors or whatever, but you have to have some kind of reasonable indication, a disclosure that was made. So I feel a little uncomfortable because I think that's kind of a legal, technical question, maybe better answered by the district attorney.
And maybe I could ask it in a different way. Okay. My husband coaches AYSO soccer, and under this, if this bill passes, he would now be a mandatory reporter. If a child on his team who had never disclosed abuse to him, it turned out that they were a victim of abuse and they were prosecuted in our local district attorney's office, would my husband be liable because he was not aware that happened? And she had never made a disclosure to him.
Coach Harris, no, I do not believe he would be. You have to individually have reasonable cause to believe that this child or another child has suffered abuse or someone has caused that injury to them. And if you have no knowledge, you have no reasonable cause. That's the standard. And again, there's absolute immunity, both criminally and civilly, for someone who reports in good faith. And the lawyers have dug very deep into what this means, but good faith is your instinct, your heart. It is objectively reasonable. What does that mean? And so that's the challenge, or that's what that individual has to go through. And if they believe it happened and they have this reasonable cause, you report and they are protected by law.
And one follow-up question. I think following up on Representative Dimbro's question, if I was a community college professor and this law passed, would I have a responsibility to talk to my students about how old they are and how old their romantic partners are, or would my reporting requirement be triggered only if I had that intimate knowledge that person was being abused or in danger?
Co-chairs, there's no responsibility on individual reporters to train or to tell their organization. Now, the organization has a responsibility to train their organization, but I don't believe under that scenario that they would.
And further, if I may, Chair and Representative Gelser, I don't think there's a responsibility in that circumstance that I'm aware of that a professor or a teacher at that level would have to inquire about the ages of their students. I think that is kind of getting at that question.
Thank you.
Representative Kahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to Mr. Ayers or Representative Gelser, and I apologize, but I'm going to be beating this drum for the next 28 days. Mm-hmm. Have you consulted with our fiscal analysis in LFO about this bill, and if there is potentially, from their perspective, potential fiscal?
Chairs and Representative Comp, we have not, specifically we have not consulted with LFO about this. I guess kind of in response to some of your concerns, I think currently there's no provision in law that says people cannot report now.
Right.
So, and it's encouraged. In fact, there's a legislative policy statement following kind of the list of mandatory reporters that talks about that it should be encouraged, and it is encouraged that people make reports when they come across or learn about child abuse. So currently, yes, most of our reports do come from mandatory reporters, but we do also receive reports from people who are non-mandated reporters. And that is our responsibility. I don't know, I'm not sure that we can answer kind of the fiscal issue here.
But just a follow-up comment, Mr. Chair. Our analysts in legislative fiscal are incredibly bright and look at policy through a minute lens. And the point that I would make is when a bill comes to us, which this one isn't, we really don't tinker with the policy. We just look at the fiscal potential, and my fear is that something as important as this would be a statute that isn't implemented because there is potential fiscal ramifications. So that's my concern. It's not anything but other than how can we make sure that this does happen if we pass this.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Gilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Comp, like any policy bill that comes before us, before we could act on this bill in the committee, Legislative Fiscal will analyze the bill, and if there is a fiscal impact where there's a requirement for additional expenditure, we will be required to send it to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
So a subsequent would be attached at that point if the LFO analysts determined that that was necessary.
Thank you very much.
Representative Parrish.
Well, I guess I got two concerns there. I think the fiscal, to Representative Comp's point, is only going to show fiscal for the agency. It's not going to show fiscal for the school district because when we're talking about, and I appreciate, you know, you've got your cost of volunteers who I would expect, given that the type of children that they're handling, that they would be mandatory reporters, whether it's in the law or not. So I appreciate that those organizations have that. But when we're talking about a parent getting on a school bus to go to the pumpkin patch, who is now a mandatory reporter, how does the school district then suddenly, you know, find a way to train those parents or get them to the website or do the enforcement piece at the school district level to ensure every parent walking on that school bus has taken a 25-minute video? I used to do the school lunch program. I couldn't get parents to come in to learn basic food safety so we wouldn't poison kids, you know, with food and snacks and serving things out of our kitchens, let alone now talking, and that's a small group of PTA parents. Now we're talking hundreds of school volunteers, and the school districts have no way to sit down with those parents and rope them and wrangle them and say, did you do this? I worry about what the impact is when every parent walking through that door, now the school district actually has to police those parents and did you do this? Because that's what this law says they're going to have to do.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on my line of questioning. So in full disclosure, in one of the other parts of my life, I'm a college teacher. And so, you know, these are issues whose practicality, you know, concern me. Having said that, you know, of course, I really applaud the desire to do whatever we can to detect abuse and deal with it, and I see this as an effort to do that. But I am concerned about the subtleties of the situation as it applies to the college campus. I think if we're talking about a situation such as at Penn State, you know, there I don't think any training is necessary. From, you know, the facts as they've been reported, the criminality of that would have jumped out at any observer. But, you know, for more subtle kinds of situations, you know, I do have concerns. And, you know, the DHS video really doesn't address any of those. I mean, it's dealing with a very different kind of situation. So I don't think it would be enough to ask college faculty to just go online and watch that video. So going back to that core question of what exactly would constitute abuse in this situation, I mean, if I did know, for example, that, you know, my 17-year-old student was in a romantic relationship with a 21-year-old, is that abuse?
Chair Wingard, members of the committee, Representative Dembro, I think that a call or a report to the agency like that, unless there was some force or forcible compulsion, some other information that we had, that is a report that's not likely to be assigned for a child abuse investigation. Offhand, I can't remember the specific elements of the child abuse statute. There's some phraseology in there that says including but not limited to, and it talks about a number of different crimes that that are in the person's crime statute.
able to.
And I think that there's, you know, there are there's mention of contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, for instance, those kinds of things. I have a hard time believing. We seldom get those calls, but we have received those calls. They're not cases. Our 17-year-old and a 21-year-old. It's just unless there's some force or some other issue that is going to be assigned as a child abuse investigation. And I'm not sure that that helps answer the question.
Well, it's. Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. I guess, you know, putting my, once this law goes into effect, then the colleges and universities are going to have to figure out what to tell their faculty, right, and how to deal with this. And so should they be telling their faculty, and or as they develop training materials or, you know, whatever, should they be telling their faculty that they should be reporting such things, you know, or not? I mean, what ought to go into, you know, a training module for such an eventuality?
That, Chair Wingard, members of the committee, Representative Jimbrough, I think it's a tricky question. I think that much of it has to do with specifically what does the law say. I think that before I felt comfortable answering what they should be told, how, you know, what to report, I'd kind of like to have a conversation with our legal counsel just to talk specifically about how the child abuse law reads and what, in fact, would be included in those, in that, in the requirement to report, specific to something like contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor or a 17-year-old who is in a romantic relationship with a 19 or a 20-year-old or something of that nature.
Representative Conger?
I think this is probably for DHS. Any idea how many mandatory reporters there are now and how many more there would be once this bill goes into effect?
Chair Wingard, members of the committee, Representative Conger, no, I don't know that right now, how many there are total in the state. I have no idea.
I have another question.
Follow up.
This is probably for Walt. And this is not a prosecutor question, but it's a legal question. So if you don't know the answer, feel free to punt. So we were talking about liability. Terrible thing to talk about, but still has to be addressed. So for an organization that employs volunteers, I understood prior testimony to say that this bill would put in place a standard, a negligence per se standard, meaning that part of the proof of negligence is now whether or not you meet this standard. So for an organization having volunteers that fall within the scope of this bill, I think the failure to train them would amount to negligence per se, it sounds like to me. I'm not sure, but so my question for you is, do you have any sense whether that's true? And if it is, for a school district or you know, a church or anything like that, if they fail, if they fail to train their volunteers, and let me use an extreme example, kind of like along the lines that Representative Parrish was bringing up, somebody who only volunteers for an hour, a parent at a school, who comes in to volunteer for a specific event for 1 hour, and they fail to train that person fails to report a case of abuse, is there potential vicarious liability for the school?
Co-chairs, Representative Conger, thank you for the question. I'm not going to fully punt here. I'm not an expert in the civil arena around negligence, but just a couple comments. One, I think that it is imperative that we train all of our organizations around child abuse, including the volunteer regimen, right now as the law stands.
That said, I think it may create liability for negligence per se if you do not train. And so we've taken the high road in our office. We're the district attorney's office, and so our folks work with child abuse every day, and we train. So my answer is I think it may, and I'll take the out saying I'm not an expert in that field, and I would recommend that any organization train their employees or their one-hour
We're not talking about employees. We're talking about one-hour volunteers who you're trying to get parents involved in taking a, you know, chaperoning a dance or something. And now you're, to be clear, I mean, there's no question, nobody would suggest that we don't want people to report potential incidents of child abuse. But there are broader implications to imposing this kind of mandate. And I want to be clear, I'm not talking about employees.
Right.
I'm not disagreeing with anything you said, but the question is, if you had a parent chaperoning a dance one time, this is a one-off instance, they become a mandatory reporter under this bill, and the school fails to persuade this parent to take the one-hour mandatory reporter training, there is possibly vicarious liability for the school under the negligence per se standard. I just want to, again, make sure that's the specific nature of the question.
Co-chairs, Representative Conger, again, not an expert, so this is just my opinion.
Understood.
There may be liability there.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Melissa is here, and I think it would be great when there's time to bring her up. I also understand Chuck Bennett is in the room and willing to address the cost to school districts. But the purpose of the language in there around the care and control of children are those people that have that direct control and authority of people. So you're talking about the scout leader, the AYSO person. You're not talking about people that are, you know, in mass. You're talking about the parent volunteer that's driving the person in the car, the person that has that control and that care.
So this would not pick up, you know, just using the chaperone example, someone who's chaperoning a high school dance.
And I believe that's why we should ask Melissa to get clarity on what that is. The intention here are those people that have that direct control. We don't want the people that are selling script out front, the people that are selling treats, the people that are putting the lunches together that don't want to take the school food poisoning training. We're talking about a more custody-focused group of people.
Representative Parrish.
But I think we heard the gentleman on the phone, and I don't remember his name,
Christian,
say that that if the school, for example, said that here is a, we're going to prescribe what you parent are supposed to do while you are here, even if that's for a three-hour dance, that creates an agency relationship. We heard him say that. So I do have some concerns that this is really still not clarified to not cover the person that goes out for the day on the pumpkin patch trip. That bothers me.
Thank you, Pam.
Will Roger Williams, Catherine Teal, and Peter Padilla please come forward? And at this point, I think it's probably fair of me to announce that we are unlikely to get to the other bills on the agenda today, and they will roll over to
Tuesday.
And do you want to say we'll roll Tuesdays over to Thursday?
And it looks like Tuesdays will roll to Thursday. So, please, Roger, introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Chairs and committee, for the record, my name is Roger Williams. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, and yes, I got it out of my mouth intact. I always have trouble with that. Would we all agree that drunk driving is a scourge that should be eradicated? There's a simple way to eliminate drunk driving in Oregon. Put a state trooper in the passenger seat of every car or on the back of every motorcycle. That would solve the problem. Why don't we do it? Among other things, because the cost would be harmful to the larger purposes of society. HB 4016 is an attempt to solve a legitimate problem. I, like you, am angered when children are sexually abused as they were at Penn State University. But this bill would undermine the ability of organizations across the state to utilize volunteers to better our society. This bill is the wrong solution. Economists have a concept called marginal value. The idea is that when you acquire more and more of something, each new increment becomes less and less valuable to you. I need to take a breath here. You're aware of my foibles. I've been here before. Here in Oregon, we already have a lot of child abuse reporting infrastructure. We have drafted 27 categories of public or private officials as mandatory child abuse reporters. We have a citizenry who abhor child abuse and will report abuse if they see it or suspect it because it's the right thing to do. What marginal value do we get from adding volunteers and independent teachers and tutors to the existing mandatory reporters? That is, what do we gain beyond what would naturally happen since they already feel a moral responsibility to report child abuse? What type of increase in substantiated reports should we expect? 20%? 10%? 1%? Remember, we already have a large number of strategically placed professionals who are reporting, plus concerned observant citizens. Now, what is the cost of HB 4016 to Oregon in terms of lost volunteers, people who are in a very real way an uplifting and nurturing element in our society? What is the cost to independent teachers and tutors who now have to face training costs, time if not money, and legal risks, both civil and criminal, if they don't get it right? And almost none of these teachers and tutors are actually making a living at what they do. It's part-time and usually low pay. This whole conversation has been instructive to me. Think about the complexity of the things that you're struggling with here. And yet we're expecting regular people to get it with a 25-minute video. Last session, there was a bill to criminalize knowingly false reports of child abuse. Representative Frederick was on one of the committees that heard that bill. When it got to the Senate, and this was a common theme, when it got to the Senate Judiciary Committee, one of your esteemed colleagues on the committee, who is an attorney, made it clear that she felt that she was competent as a regular citizen, but that she herself did not feel confident in her ability to understand all of the issues involved. And the concern was that people would be confused about whether they should report because they would be fined if they didn't, or not report because they would be fined if they did. The point being, this is a complex issue, and regular people who volunteer are not going to be sure whether they're not going to be sure what exactly their duty is, and there is going to be a chilling effect on volunteerism here in Oregon, in spite of the district attorney's that we just heard specialized situation where it's not a chilling effect. For regular people, it will be a chilling effect. You need to make a decision. Is the marginal value of HB 4016 worth the cost throughout our society with the lost volunteers? We would all like to save just one more, either an abused child or one killed by a drunk driver. It's not about how much compassion we have. It's about what we can do without damaging the larger society. Please reject 4016. Thanks.
Catherine?
For the record, chairs and members of the committee. My name's Catherine Thiel, and I am a homeschooling mom and member of a co-op that has been loosely put together with a group of eight families, who all of us volunteer our time to teach one another's children certain classes in science or arts, or and it just kind of depends on what we decide as a group would be advantageous to teach. From what I can understand of the bill, our little co-op would fall under the mandatory reporting rule because we are organized. We are an organization. And while all of us would certainly want to report any abuse that we saw, I know that except for my interest in politics in general and my being a member of that co-op, there's no way that anyone in that co-op would have any idea of their obligation to report. There's no one who, we are not affiliated with a group, we're not registered with a state in any way. We wouldn't have any way of knowing our legal obligation and our potential liability. Also, I understand this bill. I'll go on to my prepared comments. I do understand this bill from the perspective of a person involved in governance. I've been a planning commissioner in Oregon for 13 years, and my husband has served on our local city council for nearly a decade. The well-intentioned crafters of this bill are attempting to legislate a solution to an admittedly great evil. Child abuse is a horrible problem, and I don't think there's anyone in this room that doesn't want to see that problem solved in any way reduced. But if there's one thing that I've learned from my years of experience in governance, it's that when we attempt to legislate right behavior, we often fail to further promote the type of behavior that we wish to see, and we burden those who would have already acted rightly with unintended consequences. We must carefully weigh the cost-benefit analysis of such legislation before we enact it, and in my considered opinion, this bill fails to provide the benefit which would outweigh the burden, particularly in the case where volunteers are included in this legislation. This will create more problems for church or service groups trying to recruit and retain volunteers. Volunteers will have to weigh the good they can do in a volunteer capacity against the legal risks that they're running if they do not accurately assess possible signs of child abuse. It's not reasonable to additionally burden those who are already giving up their time and efforts without compensation. Organizations would be responsible to train their volunteers. Everything that I've heard here this morning has made that perfectly clear, that whether or not there's a requirement in the law to train their volunteers, they would have a responsibility because of their liability to provide training to their volunteers. This, in addition to background checks, would be they already do on their potential volunteers. And the law is also so broadly written that, again, like in regards to my little tiny co-op, it targets tiny organizations and individual providers who may not have access to adequate training or resources to provide it to one another. It is, if a volunteer is not adequately trained and does not report when they should, the organization or the provider may be liable in any number of unforeseen ways. Everything in this conversation this morning has highlighted the idea that we don't understand fully the potential negative consequences of this bill. On the other hand, volunteers are also not professionals, and this may contribute to insecurity about their ability to accurately assess a situation. This will undoubtedly result in an increase of unsubstantiated reports and increase the workload on an already overwhelmed Department of Human Services, drawing away attention and resources from valid reports that need immediate intervention. This may potentially actually increase the risk of harm to children in Oregon. It will certainly increase the likelihood of innocent families undergoing the trauma of needless child abuse investigation, which already does happen frequently in Oregon. And whether or not the child is removed from the home, as a parent, and I know I speak for my children, if someone comes to my home and in any way intimates that there is a danger of removal, of my children from my home. Just by simply suggesting that I may be unfit in some way, the trauma to myself and to my children would be grave. I would be highly alarmed, and it would reduce my trust of the community in which I participate greatly. And I think that's something that we need to underscore here, that unsubstantiated reports of child abuse have a traumatizing effect on innocent families. The recent current events have raised awareness among the general public and organizations alike. And a real solution, in my opinion, is already in motion as large financial legal penalties are causing organizations to implement effective policies to prevent child sexual abuse. Individuals are increasingly alert to the reality of child abuse, and continued efforts at community education can take advantage of this opportunity to speak to the public conscience. However, HB 4016, however good intentioned, is overly burdensome and unreasonable in its response to what is admittedly a terrible problem. I do not believe that this bill will achieve its goals and will instead be fraught with unintended consequences. How many good organizations will decide to cut beneficial programs because of the new costs and risks associated with this bill? How many talented, caring volunteers will step aside from their efforts because of the additional burden of legal liability? How many frivolous lawsuits will be filed? How many mistaken investigations will be made? How many truly endangered children will be ignored while those that should be helping them are running around on wild goose chases? As was said before, there are already 27 categories of professional occupations required to report child abuse. In addition, under the current law, a volunteer is always able to report evidence of child abuse. Ultimately, those who want to do the right thing are going to do the right thing, regardless of the law. And those who aren't going to do the right thing are not going to do the right thing, even if there's a law in place. I see this over and over again. The law does not necessarily motivate people to act rightly, but it does encourage people to unknowingly fall afoul of the law. The more opportunities that we provide for people to potentially break a law they didn't even know was out there, the higher risk we pose to our general citizenship of running afoul of the law, even though they didn't realize what their responsibilities were. For all these reasons, I oppose this bill, and I'm asking you to carefully consider the full scope of the impact that you're making in this decision today without being swept along in a wave of good intentions.
Thank you. Peter?
Good morning, co-chairs. Good morning, committee. My name is Peter Padilla. I'm from Polk County, and I oppose 4016. As it is written. My wife and I, again, not because we approve of child abuse, my wife and I in the past have been foster parents. We have seen firsthand abuse of children. We have reported abuse that came to our attention with children that were in our home, with good response from the caseworkers from DHS, with good response to the assessment centers that they were taken into, and yet the problem remains out there. Passage of another law doesn't serve this, and some of the discussion has already been had. Because in the end run, the ones that these children had to fear was the judge who wanted to still return the children back to, you know, the parents in which the abuse, you know, had happened. So the incidences out there, are serious, and they're of a concern to all of us. Resolving the problem and instituting of laws, is of concern. The good nature of this, maybe the increasing of a few categories of those who fall under the mandatory reporting law is good. But the volunteerism part is an overkill. I did email you last night to make a simple statement that criminalizing this aspect for volunteers is of deep concern. So say that my wife and I coordinate a seniors reading group, and we have five grandmothers who are reading to a group of children, once a week. They are volunteers. They're spending time with the group of seven or eight children once a week, and yet they have to be aware of what the disclosures are. And what are those disclosures? What actually is said by a child to my mother, who's 80 years old, reading to a group of seven children? What constitutes that disclosure? And if something is said, she has to make a determine as to what disclosure is, and then she poses the risk of criminalization if she doesn't pick up what that is because her hearing aids aren't working properly that day. You again criminalize volunteers, and then there was a contradiction made that basically says, well, that there hasn't been prosecution of volunteers in the past, but the contradiction is there hasn't been prosecution of those, but this law would criminalize it. So there is a concern there that basically in the current law, volunteers that see evidence that are told are able to report, and volunteers of the nature, if they have the sense of abuse taking on, that they will report. But this law only poses the criminalization of good citizens that are doing volunteer jobs.
Thank you. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for raising what I think were a couple of important points of clarification. If someone was making a disclosure to someone who was deaf or hard of hearing and their hearing aid was off so they didn't hear it, they would not have knowledge of that information, and therefore they wouldn't be required to disclose. I think the other thing is that...
It's not hearing, it's the perception, Maybe they did hear, but they didn't hear clearly, or to what level...
Thank you. And let me clarify. One, in order to trigger that standard to report, one themselves has to have reasonable belief that the child is being harmed. And disclosure is a word. It's kind of a, I think we all in our different occupational areas get into using words that don't make sense in other places. So a disclosure would be if someone came to a reading volunteer and said, my father raped me last night. That would be a disclosure. It's not a form. And then I had a question. Are any of you aware that it is against the law to drive while talking on a cell phone or to text while driving? Yes. And do you know how to use a hands-free device?
Actually, no, because I don't have one. I just don't talk on the phone.
You don't talk on the phone. But are you a member of an organization that directly informed you of that change in the law or that provided you with training on how to use a hands-free device?
I work for the city of Portland, and they told us that that was a no-no, but they didn't give us any training.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Comp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a research question for staff. Would you please check? My previous knowledge was that homeschool parents were required to, I can't think of the correct word, but register with an education service district that they are homeschooling their child, and that under the provisions, what I understand of this bill, then the ESD, the education service district, should do the training for those homeschool parents. But I would appreciate an update on the current statute about homeschool parents registering so that one thing, that we as a state know how many students there are in our state that are being served in that sort of thing, because, I won't get into all the other parts of why they should be registering with an AESD.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And I'd forgotten the one other piece was the question about the not prosecuting. I think that question wasn't specifically about volunteers. It was about that universe of tens of thousands of mandatory reporters that we already have in the state of Oregon, and that there isn't a history of prosecuting that. So say a person had, and again on that disclosure piece, another disclosure would be if a child came and said, my mother punishes me by putting her cigarettes out on my back at the end of the day. It's those kinds of things. It's not just sexual abuse, it's physical abuse as well.
Okay, panel, thank you very much. We'll Brian Ray, Jameson Ulibarri, and David Valdez, please come forward. Brian, please start.
My name is Dr. Brian Ray from Salem, Oregon. I've been a certified teacher, taught in Oregon, Washington. I'm a father of one son and seven daughters. I've been a professor of education at the undergraduate and graduate university levels, and I've taught teachers, and I'm also a church leader and have been for a long time.
Probably shouldn't just run through that you have seven daughters, that we need a moment to process that.
It's a little challenging sometimes. I'd just like to say that HB 4016 is an ineffective, emotional, and anti-freedom response to great evil that is done to children in Oregon, and I'm opposed to the 4016. It will definitely, as others have said, and I'll try to skip some repetition, that it will be chilling on many people, especially those in smallish-type, volunteer-type situations. I could give you very concrete examples in a smallish church that I'm a part of. Fourth, I'm a researcher, and I would like to know where the research is anywhere in the country that shows any clear correlation, let alone causal relationship, between mandatory reporting or this kind of mandatory reporting and stopping or preventing child abuse. I've been looking for it, can't find it. In fact, Dr. Gary Melton in the Child Abuse and Neglect Journal, 2005, volume 29, said, quote, mandated reporting is a bankrupt policy, unquote. And I'll provide more to you folks after I leave here today. He gives reasons for that and so forth and so on. Fifth, and not many people have explained this, but taking care of children is the parent's responsibility. And I heard the term in loco parentis. It's been around for a long time in the United States, but not for the entire history of the United States. It is a parent's job to determine who is safe and reasonable for his children or her children to be with, and if there is some concern, send the children out two by two or with people who they trust. They're not supposed to be trusting people who are not trustworthy. So it's a parent's job, and I think we need to think about that in this whole discussion. My next point is that Representative Gelser said, quote, hopefully, comma, any person would report, unquote. I agree. Here is where the major problem arises. What we have here is a basic philosophical religious worldview that says the government's job is to try to force people to be nice or try to force people to agree with what Representative Gelser or others think they should do. Another perspective of law and the government's role is that the government is to punish those who do evil. People who harm children are doing evil to the children. If your main concern is to reduce child abuse and to keep children from being harmed, then I'll be really blunt. How about if you propose a law that says the first time you're convicted by a jury of your peers, you are scourged publicly? And I know that sounds funny in this day and age. The second time you are convicted by a jury of your peers, you are scourged, and then you're either castrated or given a clitoridectomy. I guarantee you that within 2 years, child abuse in Oregon would decrease by 90% or more. You have no evidence that this is going to do the job you want. And you have it's a totally philosophical religious worldview that says the state's role is to try to get me or volunteer in a small church to do the what you think is the nice thing to report suspected child abuse. When, as Representative Gelser said herself, We would expect people to do that. That's the kind of thing we want in America, in Oregon, and that is what we want. So it's a major problem without evidence that more mandatory reporters is going to reduce child abuse, when we know from common sense that if there is swift, severe punishment for those who are convicted by a jury of their peers, you will see less child abuse, and it'll be much faster and a greater reduction ever than you would get from this kind of law and passing this kind of law. I'll stop there.
Thank you, sir. Jameson.
My name is, excuse me, co-chairs. Thank you for your time. My name is Jameson Uleberry. I'm from Woodburn. I'm a parent, and I'm a volunteer in my church. I have been a volunteer coach and assistant coach in more formal and less formal capacities. And so, you know, I'm here today. I feel a little bit awkward because I, like everybody else has stated, I abhor child abuse, sexual abuse. I've seen the results of it in the last for decades. And we all would like to see that stop. We'd all like to do whatever we can to help stop it. But I oppose this bill because, speaking from a volunteer perspective, it wouldn't slow down my volunteer work, but I know a lot of people would have second thoughts. It would be an onerous burden on them to take that legal responsibility. A lot of people, I think, would refuse to step up to volunteer. For instance, in our church, we've got perhaps 50 or 45 once a month or every month and a half child care volunteer workers who will teach Sunday school, you know, just on occasion. How many of those people won't do it if we're trying to recruit them and say, not only do you get to help children, you get to take this extra legal liability upon you and have this extra training required? I think it would, in that sense, in the broader sense, would backfire, because there's so many programs out there that depend on volunteers to help kids and to help bridge that generation gap, you know, between children and adults. I've talked to child psychologists who said that the problem in teens' lives today is there's not enough connection between the young and the adults. You know, we have children, teenagers, 12 years old and up, who help to volunteer in these settings. Well, does this apply to them? If I have a 12-year-old daughter who's an assistant nursery worker, would she then be a mandatory reporter if she's volunteering every other month, but she's going to be a mandatory reporter 24/7 for the rest of her life? It sounds like the answer to that is yes, and I think it's just too broad of a sweep. I think that's all I have to say. Thank you for your time.
David.
Co-chairs, thank you for your time. My name is David Valdez, and I come before you as a parent and the sufferer of abuse at the hands of a mandatory reporter for many years in my childhood. I'm alive today because of volunteers. Simply put. In later years, my mother became a school counselor, so I'm highly familiar with mandatory reporter rules as well, because I got to watch my mother not only as she secured her master's in counseling from OSU, but also subsequently. There are many times that we try to place professionals in professional positions. That's their job. But when we begin to put non-professionals in professional positions, we run into problems, both from a training perspective and from a skills perspective. I'm extremely concerned that when we put non-professionals in professional positions, we give them a huge burden. They don't do what they're supposed to do anymore. They do other things. Those same people who helped save my life, those people would have a huge burden today if they had to deal with this bill. Because it's not a 25-minute video on a website. There are subtleties, as Representative Dembro mentioned. There are costs, as Representative Comp mentioned. And they're scary. And they're not scary in as much as we don't want to protect children. They're scary because they don't accomplish this. We've heard already from attorneys that no one gets prosecuted for reports, which means the bill itself is toothless. It has no impact from a positive perspective. The volunteers get no benefit from that. Because if they fail to report, they're not going to be prosecuted, as has been stated in testimony this morning. But here's the scariest part for me as a taxpayer in this state. According to DHS's most recent child welfare data book for 2010, there were 71,000 reports of child abuse in the state. Of those 71,000, less than 50% were pursued by CPS. Of that less than 50%, only a little over 7,000 were actually founded, which means we have an 11% hit rate today on abuse reports. If you create whole new classes of mandatory reporters who are not skilled and who are not sufficiently trained, there is no question but that 71,000 report number will increase, and probably dramatically, because the people that you're adding are no longer professionals in professional capacities. They are soccer coaches. They are youth group leaders. They are baseball coaches. They are Boy Scout leaders. They're Girl Scout leaders. They're a bunch of people who are volunteering their time to help children. Yes, there is a possibility that some of them are going to encounter abuse situations. Absolutely. That's the nature of their job. But that's not what they're paid for, and that's not what they're trained for. And so the likelihood is they'll either err on the side of not reporting because the rule is toothless, or they'll err on the side of reporting just to make sure they're not liable. And so the people who are really being abused, the kids who really we want to protect, those are the kids who may very well be neglected in lieu of 140,000 reports in 2013. And how do you get through 140, maybe 200,000 reports? We don't really know how to scope it, but what we can do is look at the fact that of all the reports in the 71,000, 74% were by mandatory reporters. So if we look at the hit rate between mandatory reporters already and the amount of reports, we can extrapolate fairly significant numbers, fairly significant increases, and how many kids are going to lose the chance for salvation? How many of them are not going to have the safe haven because somebody didn't volunteer or because somebody over-reported and therefore CPS missed that category of kid? That's my concern with the bill. Thank you for your time.
Representative Parrish. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for your testimony. I think it's important to make a clarification about what it means to have a substantiated allegation of abuse. Those reports that are unsubstantiated after an investigation, it does not necessarily mean that abuse did not occur or that it was a false allegation. It just means that the department wasn't able to gather the evidence to be able to substantiate that. Excellent case in point in my district, a little girl named Carly Sheehan was murdered in my district in 2004. She was the subject of two unsubstantiated allegations of abuse in the 6 months prior to being beaten to death.
My concern with that, are we going to have more of them? Because there's going to be more reports that are going to require more investigations, and so she and more of her are going to be slipping through the system because of reports that may or may not be valid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Chuck Bennett, will you come forward? Yes, sir. You're the next contestant.
I'm going to bring my lifeline.
Hold on, we have to read. No. Sure, to clarify who you are for the record, and I think Representative Gelser had a question.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators.
Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association.
Thank you. And I understood you might have a response to the issue of cost and districts and volunteers.
Yes. We have just very briefly, we have requested fiscal concerns from representatives of school districts, particularly the school business officials. The answer we got was, if any, minimal. Primarily deals with policy revision. This is not seen as a cost item by school districts. We really appreciate the question. We hope in the future the legislature will look at placing fiscal impact statements on local school districts in as part of the legislative process. At this point, that is not a formal process that's done. Unfortunately, I think these are really good questions. As to the specifics of the bill, we support the bill as amended. We think it resolves, the amendments resolve concerns that we had. I would just submit to you, and Morgan can expand on it, we believe this bill applies to a very specific kind of volunteer. There's been a misunderstanding of how often we allow children to be alone with volunteers in public schools, apparently. This is not some free-for-all in your public schools. And that this bill, and we're very interested in Representative Conger's questions, we believe does not change our liability, it merely clarifies our liability. We were, if someone gets harmed by a volunteer, we're gonna get sued in this situation. We think this just clarifies the situation. And I'll let Morgan talk about the role of volunteers.
I think our understanding of the bill as written is that, for example, if a smart reader were to come into...
You sure you tell us who you are?
Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association. Co-chairs, our understanding of the bill is that, and there were a lot of questions brought up today, and some of the testimony even confused me a little bit, but our understanding of the intent of the bill is that a parent who comes in to volunteer to, say, read to kids in class while the teacher is there during class time would not become a mandatory reporter, that the types of school volunteers we're looking at would be more like coaches or overnight chaperones when they are by themselves with kids. That's our understanding of the intent of the bill. So that was a concern we would have, is, you know, your average, you know, grandma, grandpa, mom, and dad that want to come in and spend a little time in their kid's class, or even larger events where they're, you know, there's lots of volunteers, a school carnival or something like that. Our understanding is that as long as there are school employees there who are in charge of the events, charge of the class, that those parents or volunteers would not be mandatory reporters. That's our understanding.
Representative Parrish?
I guess I would kind of dispute the notion that teachers, you know, are kind of there supervising parents. I mean, I have three kids. I've been on many a field trip where you take your group this way and you take your group that way, or teacher leaves the classroom to run down to the office or go grab a cup of coffee or whatever, and suddenly you're left as a parent with 30 kids. And I don't think that's a school board policy. I don't think the implementation of something like this is simply just, we're going to have a school board policy that says this is how we handle this. And particularly when we're talking about how do you identify which of those parents is going to come into that situation and potentially be the parent who gets left in the classroom with 30 kids. I've had that happen on many occasions, you know, versus the parent who's going to be supervised by a teacher or, you know, some other faculty or staff person. I don't know that the school can really identify which groups of parents those are going to be.
We believe we're going to have to under this bill. And if you are left alone with children, you will become a mandatory reporter under this bill. And that'll be, presumably, the policy will clarify that. At this point, that is not a clear situation. But if you're being left alone with children, my children, I'd like to know that you are taking responsibility and that there is some level of responsibility placed on you. I'm sure you feel the same way. You don't want your children left alone with in a situation where there hasn't been some level of training in this area. So we're pretty comfortable with this.
Well, I guess that's, I don't know if it's a follow-up question, but, you know, Representative Conger asked earlier about the class. How does this expand the class size of people we're talking about here? There's, I think, 500 plus thousand kids in this state. We're going to assume that, you know, coming from two kids in a house and two parent home, we're talking 100,000 people now that potentially parents who volunteer in classes, you know, that
we wish
expand that
we wish.
Class. No, but you know what I mean? I mean, that's
we'd like to have two parents in a family talking to their children
I'm
about
assuming
their
that,
education.
You know, that we're going to get a quarter of those people are parents who this could apply to if they chose to volunteer for an event, get left alone for, you know, 15 minutes in the classroom with a kid.
And Representative Parris, what you might expect to see from districts in my conversations with a couple district folks is you know, for example, many districts right now require a LEDS check, the state police criminal background check, if you want to be a volunteer in the kids' school. And what you might expect some districts to do is put information on there that, you have the potential to be a mandatory reporter if you are going to find yourself in a situation where you're volunteering and you're going to be alone with kids. You might see an indemnification form, you know, asking parents to waive the liability of the district. I mean, those are the types of things that I've heard from the field you would expect folks. We already have trainings available on abuse, et cetera, through DHS that parents can come to, and we're required to notify parents during the school year that they could come. You'd probably see districts putting that on the volunteer forms, for example. But those are the kinds of things I've heard when I've talked to some folks in the field.
I guess I've been a volunteer for 7 years in my kids' school. I've never filled out a form, so that would be a new one for me.
Representative Conger.
Just wanted to clarify something. Chuck, I think some of your comments suggest that you're conflating the idea that volunteers who are left alone with kids should have training, that you should be doing things like background checks to make sure that they're not abusers. And I want to be crystal clear. I think that if someone who is acting as an agent of a school abuses a child who is in their care, then the school is going to be liable. I mean, that's not in doubt. What the nature of my questions had to do with, does this open up a lot of opportunity for people who are volunteering and fail to report an instance of potential abuse? Does that vicariously create liability for the institution where they're volunteering, which would include schools, it would include scouts, it would include a lot of different things, not instances where that agent actually commits the abuse?
No, I understood.
Okay.
And I'm not conflating. I think our liability, if it was reported currently to a volunteer, we could potentially face liability as well. I think this just clarifies the situation. We're just not uncomfortable with this situation. We were initially, I think, looking at the bill. I think all of us reacted. It's sort of the, and I heard it today, the oh no, what's this mean kind of thing. But I think if you sit down and look at individual circumstances for all kinds of organizations, there's no threat here. This is about the protection of children and hopefully the reduction of child abuse. And I think we're all here for that.
And Representative Conger, to your question specifically, I posed that to one of our attorneys for the question and have posed this question to Representative Gelser. And basically the response I got back was, yes, but we're already liable. It probably just makes us more so, or as Chuck said, it clarifies it. It makes a clearer line. If something happens, if one of our volunteers in our schools does something terrible, we're probably going to get sued. If they're also a mandatory reporter, that's maybe one more thing that goes into the lawsuit or one more factor to consider. But again, I think as long as the legislative intent and the bill are very crystal clear that we're talking about volunteers who are have supervision of children without school employees, teachers, educational assistants, administrators, and those are the people that are mandatory reporters, we're comfortable, because we would have that concern if the smart reader who comes in for a half hour or an hour, you know, on a daily basis comes into the class and reads, becomes a mandatory reporter. I think that would be concerning for us, because some people, just that whole notion, mandatory reporting child abuse, it could give some folks the willies. But if you're the kind of volunteer where you're taking on that huge extra responsibility, I find a hard time, at least in the K-12 setting, how you can make a really good argument that those people shouldn't be mandatory reporters. If they have unsupervised control over kids in hotel rooms or on road trips,
you believe that the bill as draft, or as amended, I should say, we're assuming with the -3 amendments, mm-hmm. that would be clear, that it's only affecting what would essentially be people who are being left alone with kids.
That's our understanding of the bill, Representative. Okay. If we need further clarification, we're happy to work with the committee on that point.
And what? Representative Conger, I'm happy to work with legislative council to double, triple check to make sure that that's the case.
One other thought.
Quickly.
quickly, would be we are also concerned about the chilling effect on volunteers that hopefully, if you do, and we hope you do, pass this amended bill, you will hold some sort of discussion during the interim in advance of the 2013 session so we can kind of get a feel if we are having a problem with volunteers and there is a need to make changes. That's something I think we can speculate about, but we hope we'll keep track of that issue.
Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have run over and out of time, so we're going to have to close the hearing on House Bill 4016, although we will carry it over to Tuesday, and based on my conversation with my co-chair, we're going to take the other bills first on Tuesday, and if there is time, then we'll come back to 4016.
And we're carrying over what was currently posted for Tuesday. We're going to move those to Thursday.
We're moving those bills to Thursday. Okay. So I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 4016 and adjourn the committee for today.